Some of you may remember from your college days that the professors come in two types. I don't mean the liberals and the conservatives or the men and the women. I mean the dogs and the cats. The dogs run around in packs and they bark a lot, and each one tries to become the top dog. But the cats are solitary. They like to mark territory as their own so that other cats will stay out. And then among the professors of transportation planning, all the dogs chase after the moving cars, or they ride around in cars with their heads hanging out the windows, excited by speed. And the cats do not like riding around in cars, and they never hang their heads out the windows. Instead, the cats inspect all of the parked cars, and they mark the tires. Cats also enjoy sleeping on the hood of a newly parked car while the engine is still warm. And they use this time to brood about the economics of parked cars. Well, cars are parked 95% of the time, as yours are now. So while the dogs chase after cars during the 5% of the time that cars are moving, I thought I could find out something about the other 90% of the time that the cars are at rest. And after all, in an audience this large, some of you were probably even conceived in a parked car. Well, I'm a little bit humbled to be coming from California to talk to you about transportation, because the last thing you want to hear is somebody from California telling you how to run your business. And most people have the impression that we paved over the whole state with parking. There's some truth to that. And then we chopped down all our redwood trees to make gas stations, which we've done a bit of. But when you look at California from the air, you can see that a lot of it looks like this. This is a view of Silicon Valley. This pattern stretches on for miles. It's hard to even know what would be the address of this building. What street is it on? Would you ever want to walk or bicycle in this neighborhood, if you can call it that? And all these cars are parked free on a weekday afternoon. But parking is free to us only in our role as drivers. Because the cost doesn't go away just because the driver doesn't pay for it. Somebody has to pay for the parking, and that somebody is everybody. We pay for parking dearly in every aspect of our lives except as a driver. We pay for it as a taxpayer, a homeowner, an apartment renter, a consumer, an investor, an employer, an employee. In every role in life, we pay for free parking except as a driver. And to some extent, it's because cities require this pattern of development. So I'd like to start with some background for parking policies. I'm sorry I don't have the numbers for Australia. I feel more comfortable criticizing the United States in any case. But let's put this parking in context In America, our motor vehicles consume an eighth of the world's oil supply every day. And I suspect on a per capita basis, Australia must be in a similar situation. That I doubt if on a per capita basis you consume a lot less than we do. And we import two-thirds of our oil, often from hostile countries. And unlike the Australians, we're paying for it with borrowed money. We have many more vehicles than licensed drivers. I think if everybody with a license drove away at the same time in the United States, there would be 22 million motor vehicles left behind. And we pay for parking on only about 1% of our trips. Now, it may seem unlikely that you pay for parking only 1% of your trips when you're in a place like downtown Los Angeles or downtown Melbourne. But many people who come to those places come by public transport, and that when you're out in the suburbs, it's often hard to find a place where you could pay even 20 cents for an hour for parking. I think that this is unsustainable, and anything that's unsustainable will eventually stop. the question is how? Well, I made a table with some numbers from provided by two Australians, Jeffrey Kenworthy and Felix Laub, and they gathered data on 40 large cities in the world, the number of parking spaces in the CBD and the size of the CBD. And it's only in the CBD that cities have any idea how many parking spaces there are, because they hire some consultant to go out and count them. It's heavily regulated, but most cities have no, could never tell you. I'm sure there's no planner in Melbourne who could tell you how many parking spaces there are in Melbourne, or even give a good guess. But you can for the CBD. And so the third column shows the parking spaces per hectare, and Los Angeles is right up there on the top. But look at number two. Now, when I got here first, I thought, well, that can't be true. There's all this public transport. How could there be so many parking spaces? But when you start walking around Melbourne, it seems to be there are parking garages everywhere. So I'm not saying these numbers are right. I'm saying they come from Australia. And most of the top 10 cities are U.S. or Australian. And then when you look at the ones that are lower, the sort of cities where you would like to visit, like London or Paris or Zurich or Copenhagen, they all have much less parking. So I'd just like to talk about the three basic elements of transportation systems. We don't always think of them this way, but it's an old-fashioned way, and I think it's the right way, that there are three basic elements of any transportation system: the vehicles, the rights of way, and the terminal capacity. When you look at most systems, it's very obvious what they are. The trains, of course, need tracks and stations, and when you go to fly, you have to go to airports, and ships need seaports. And automobile travel has the same three elements, but we usually don't think of it, parking as such as an essential part of the transportation system. And I think that, as Elliot mentioned, that parking is a blind spot in most studies of automobile transportation. And when parking is considered, it usually has a qualifier like mere parking or only parking or something like that. But what's different about parking is that the cost of the terminal capacity is shifted out of the transportation sector into every other sector of the economy. When you take an airplane and land at an airport, you know your ticket is paying for the airport. But when you drive a car, somehow the cost of the terminal capacity, which is a huge share of the total cost, is paid for by somebody else, that somebody else being everybody. Well, zoning also has three basic elements. This is getting back to urban planning. We have the permitted uses, which are familiar, the residential or retail or gas stations or whatever, and the permitted size, usually regulated by height and setbacks. And those two elements of zoning were established right when zoning began in early in the 20th century. But the third element of zoning didn't emerge until about the 1950s, and that is the off-street parking requirements. And that's different from the other two, because the first two say what you can and you can't do with your property. You can build a single-family housing here, but not multifamilies. But parking requirements tell you what you must do. Before you build anything, you have to provide this required parking. So it imposes a cost in a way that the other two do not. And I think it's done it very carelessly, that how do we know how many parking spaces to require? Well, here's the most recent publication in the United States called Parking Standards. That sounds like a very responsible thing to do, standards. They're really not standards, they're just requirements. And here is the first page of the land uses in the most recent survey. And the number of land uses go on for eight pages. This just gets down to boarding house. So every land use has to have a requirement, and planners have to know how many parking spaces to require for each one, even though they have no training whatever on how to do it. Here's one of the things showing the boom in the 1990s is that the previous survey only had one land use called adult use, and now there are 10. You have to know the difference between adult theaters and adult cabarets, the bookshops and things like that. Here you can see what they look like. So it's hard to know how many spaces to require for each one of these things. That at least we don't have the problems that some countries have about knowing about how to deal with their parking problems. How big should the vehicles be? I imagine this. Some people probably arrived at the Melbourne Cup in a vehicle like this, and how do you require spaces for that? When you look at the parking requirements, each one by itself may seem to make sense. But when you look at all of them together, all the 10,000 commandments for parking, they begin to seem very irrational. It's easy when you can relate the number of parking spaces to the number of people, although there's often a gender distinction. Every land use seems to require at least one space per person, except for religious uses. But even then, there's a gender distinction. But it looks as, you know, it has some kind of plausibility when you see it one at a time. But other requirements are dazzling in their combination of precision and inventiveness. How many spaces for a gas station? You have to always have to relate it to something. Well, what about per fuel nozzle or a number of gallons of water in a pool or something like that? You have to have how many spaces per what. And it's very difficult for some land uses. So I think we've made two basic mistakes in our parking policy, and I understand there are a lot of planners here. I'm not criticizing planners. I'm talking about practices. And I think some of our practices are backwards. We require lots of off-street parking, and we keep curb parking free or cheap. And I looked at for Victoria. I always try to see what the city is doing before I go there. They say, here's the purpose. It's almost tautological. You have to do what we're telling you to do. This is the key to it. We're not going to let anything happen until you provide the required parking spaces. That is a very straightforward explanation of what they're doing. And they always have a laundry list of purposes of doing it. This is of all planning, not just for planning for parking. But I think minimum parking requirements conflict with every single one of these goals. It makes it difficult to achieve every other goal, especially the last one. Seems very high-minded, but I think that our parking requirements make it difficult to achieve. And when you look at a city from the air, you can always look for a Westfield in any city on Earth, I think. Certainly I live within a short walk of one in Los Angeles. And they seem to have a lot of parking. It's all the required parking. And when you actually look at the requirements that are listed in the Victoria planning provisions, you see what they look like. What are the land uses that they have and how many spaces they require. I think you can tell something about a culture by the land uses for which it requires parking, and that may include Melbourne. I've never seen the parking requirements for a betting agency before, so it sounds to me as if Victorians like to gamble. And I've never seen such high parking requirements for a tavern, so I suspect that all Australians like to drink and drive. what is that, 60 parking spaces per 100 square meters? Can you imagine that? You know, I thought I must have misread it, or I can't have misread it, but it must have been a typo or something. It must be 6, but it's 60. And then here's another page. I've never seen a parking requirement for bowling greens, so I suppose that Australians like lawn bowling. And then when you say, well, how much parking is required? If you think the average parking space requires 30 square meters of land for the car itself when it's parked, and for the aisles and the ramps if it's a garage, it's about 30 square meters. So if you multiply 30 square meters times 60 spaces, that's 1,800 square meters for 100 square feet of bar floor area. Could that really be true? And then for a funeral parlor, it's 900 square meters of parking for 100 square feet of a funeral parlor. So I suppose not only do Australians like to drink and drive, but they want a lot of people to come to their funerals. And if you have designated drivers in Australia, you'd think that that would lead to carpooling. You know, for the one land use where you'd think that the planners would try to discourage solo driving, you have a very high parking requirement. And for most land uses, it looks as though the Victoria planning provisions require more space for parking than for people. And this is true in just about every city. And that's why in almost every city, the amount of parking is, parking is the single biggest land use. More than retail, more than offices, more than housing. The footprint of parking is greater than the footprint of any other land use. But these aren't frivolous. They didn't happen for no reason, these parking requirements. They happen because people think there's a terrific shortage of parking, because almost all the parking you can see is full. So if you walk around Melbourne, you see that most of the curb spaces are full. You don't have any surface parking lots, which is very civilized, but when you look at the ground floor of the parking structures, they're mostly full, and lots of oil stains. And so everybody has a sort of a bias towards thinking there's a shortage. But when you go to the top deck of a parking structure, often you don't see any oil spots. Maybe not in Melbourne, but certainly this is in Los Angeles. This is a parking structure in West Hollywood where there's a terrific shortage of parking. Everybody thinks that we really need higher parking requirements because every parking space I see is occupied. But a higher parking requirement won't help. I think we've created what Sir Peter Hall called a great planning disaster, by which he meant a planning process that costs a lot of money and has gone seriously wrong. And I think that minimum parking requirements, they skew our travel choices towards cars, that they spread the city out with all the parking between the land uses, so it's harder to walk. And if you can park free when you get where you're going, well, cars are the natural way to drive. They distort the urban form towards even lower density than most people would voluntarily choose. The buildings themselves are often distorted by the required parking. You shoehorn the building in after you provide the required parking. It makes housing more expensive because it has to include the cost of the required parking. In many cities, it seriously impedes the reuse of older buildings because it was said in Victoria planning provisions, you can't introduce a new use to an existing building until you provide the required parking. So if an old building doesn't have all the parking required for a bar, well, you just can't have a bar. So it makes it difficult to reuse many buildings. It makes it harder to own your own home, and you don't have to, I think, explain why it damages the economy, because it forces so much spending on the economy, and it doesn't require any explanation about how it harms the environment, I don't think. So I recommend three basic reforms that some cities are undertaking. It's charge the right price for curb parking, which is a tautology, I suppose, but to be specific about it, it means the lowest price you can charge and still have one or two vacant spaces on every block, about 85% occupancy. So the spaces are well used, they're 85% occupied, But they're readily available because wherever you go, you see one or two vacant spaces at the curb. And the reason they're not filled is because they're not cheap. They're not too cheap. Sometimes the right price is zero, but in many cases it'll be higher. And then to make this politically popular, cities are beginning to dedicate all or a share of the meter revenue to pay for public services in the neighborhoods that generate it. That is, if the street has meters, the meter money goes to improve the neighborhood with the meters. You can put your wires underground, you can rebuild your sidewalks, you can plant street trees, you get extra police protection, whatever the locals want. And that makes it politically possible, because if you get the money, then you can understand that it's reasonable to charge for parking. You begin to see the world through the eyes of a parking lot owner. And then once we do that, there's no need for minimum parking requirements because there's no shortage of parking. And if you do that, then you can have a better buildings, a better architecture, better urban design. So I'll just go through these three recommendations. The performance-based parking prices are to adjust prices up or down. Nudge them up when there's a shortage of parking and nudge them down when there's a surplus so that rather than 85%, that's sort of shorthand way of saying one or two vacant spaces on every block. San Francisco is going in this direction. Here, you don't know what the prices are going to be until you begin trying to achieve the right result. And they just said, well, we don't know what it's going to be, but this is an illustration of what they could be. Could be higher in the morning if demand is higher. When demand is high, the price will be high. When demand is low, the price will be low. Sometimes it'll be free, and sometimes it'll be very expensive. And because they have a grant from the federal government to implement this reform, they have money for graphic designers, which is always a wonderful thing. And they just show, well, here's the problem, that some streets have no spaces available, and some spaces have too many spaces available. So what are you going to do? Well, you nudge up the price on the top street and nudge it down on the bottom street, and this is what you're aiming for. Now, some people think that charging market rate prices for curb parking is a huge social upheaval, like Prohibition or the Reformation. But really, it's just moving one car off of that top block onto the bottom block. Is that really so much of a change that we think that is politically beyond our capability to achieve this? It's just we put it in the too hard box and start thinking of a congestion charges or something like that, which also won't happen probably. But I think this very small change can lead to a big result. It's sort of like the Goldilocks principle that you learned when you were a kid, that porridge shouldn't be too hot or too cold, and beds shouldn't be too soft or too firm. Well, prices shouldn't be too high or too low. And they're just right when they're one or two vacant spaces. Now, San Francisco also had money to hire a video producer to show what they're trying to achieve.
Finding a parking space can be frustrating and time-consuming. It's estimated close to a third of city traffic is caused by drivers circling while looking for a space. Some drivers just give up and double park. This clogs our streets and needlessly pollutes the air. These cars slow down public transit to get in the way of emergency vehicles. And drivers focused on finding parking create a hazard for pedestrians and cyclists. There is a better way. San Francisco is testing new parking technology and a flexible approach to pricing that is designed to make parking work better for everyone. SF Park's goal is to have at least one parking space available per block. That way, drivers can park near a specific destination without the need to circle the block or double park. This also provides a steadier flow of customers to business owners. SF Park provides safer and clearer streets for everyone. Here's how it works. Newly installed parking sensors detect when parking space is available. Drivers will be able to check parking availability rates online, by text message, and by smartphone before heading to their destination. This will help you decide whether to drive, take public transit, bike, or walk. When people choose to drive, new SF Park meters will make paying easier. In addition to taking coins, the new meters will accept credit cards and SFMTA parking cards. Parking time limits will be extended. Easier payment and extended time limits will help drivers avoid tickets. Prices at city-owned parking garages will be adjusted to provide an attractive alternative to meter parking. Parking rates will be adjusted based on demand, once a month, never by more than 50 cents. So, in areas where it seems nearly impossible to find a parking space, rates will increase until at least one space is available most of the time. And in areas where open parking spaces are plentiful, rates will decrease until most of the empty space is filled, or until rates bottom out at as little as 25 cents per hour. SF Park is designed to ensure that drivers easily find an open space near their destination. SF Park will help people plan ahead, making informed decisions about the best time and the best way to visit busy areas. SF Park begins its federally funded pilot project in 8 areas across San Francisco, starting in the summer of 2010. Use sfpark.org to learn more. Sign up for project plans and to let us know what you think. Circle less, live more.
Well, I hope it turns out as well as the video suggests, but it isn't that difficult to explain. In fact, that video explains it about 2 minutes, but it takes me an hour to say. But when you look at what most cities do, they do just the opposite of what SF Park is talking about. Here on the horizontal axis, I showed the price of curb parking at various locations in Los Angeles. On the vertical axis is the price of the off-street parking at that place, and always the price of the off-street parking is much higher than the price of the curb parking. So the city is, by setting these low curb parking prices, is telling you, drive around and hope of finding a curb space. Drive around until you see somebody pulling out so you can pull in. That's the signal. That's the price signal that cities are sending. Here's an extreme case in New York City. Where it's always the first hour in a parking structure is very high. And here's the price of a parking meter right in front of that parking structure. So if you want to park for an hour, it's really telling you that you might as well plan to arrive early and cruise around until you can find a curb parking space. I think it's also true here in Melbourne. Here on the left is the prices for one of your off-street parking structures. And it's a very peculiar pricing structure. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I hope that somebody at the tea break can explain to me why it costs $16 for the whole day if you drive in during rush hour. But if you drive in at off-peak, it costs you $19 an hour for the each of the first 3 hours. These parking rates don't just happen. There's a reason for them that I haven't really fully understood. And the curb parking is $2 for 30 minutes, or the normal price is $4 an hour. So certainly the city of Melbourne is telling you, cruise for parking. It's the way to save money. You may congest traffic, you may pollute the air, you may waste fuel, you may interfere with pedestrians and bicyclists, but it'll save you a lot of money. So this leads to a lot of cruising for curb parking. I suppose you want to park for an hour, and curb parking is 50 cents an hour, and off-street parking is $2 an hour. How long would you be willing to cruise? You've all done it. Maybe some of you did it. No, you couldn't do it here because you could only park for an hour at the curb. But we've all done it. And there have been studies of cruising for curb parking. The first one was done appropriately in Detroit in 1927 when they tried to estimate the share of traffic that was cruising. And other studies have estimated how long it takes to find a space once you get to your destination. The most recent ones in New York I like, that they interviewed drivers who were stopped at traffic lights and asked, are you cruising for curb parking? And in one place it was 28%, in another one 45% of the cars. To think that you could, with a small pricing reform like what San Francisco is intending to do, you could get 45% of the cars off the street, and those cars don't want to be there. That is VMT, that's vehicle travel they don't want to make. It's not ejecting people out of their cars. It is ejecting them into parking spots rather than cruising around. So about this is, people look for parking where they for cruising where they expect to find it, and that the average was about 32%. And this was on four continents over 80 years. They've done these surveys. One that I really like a lot was done in Chicago just before World War II, is that they stationed students, I'm sure they were students like Ian, at every curb, and they the students marked down the time and the license plate of every car that passed, and they showed whether it went straight ahead or left or right. They wrote down the exact time so they could recreate the path of travel from all these records of which cars passed which intersection at which time. And some drivers were, you know, sort of fixated on going to one spot. Others were open to new experiences, and they would try a different route. They would do whatever it takes. That sort of like, I don't know if the Seinfeld program made it to Australia, but in one of the events at Seinfeld, George was driving to Jerry's apartment, and Elaine was his passenger, and George was cruising for parking. And she said, well, I'll pay for parking. We can pay right in Jerry's building. I'll pay for parking. And George says, I never pay for parking. Paying for parking is like going to a prostitute. You know, why should I pay if, when I apply myself, maybe I can get it for free? And I think that's one of our problems. We're trying to get things for free. Something that's very expensive, we're trying to get it for free. And that doesn't work out. And it also leads to a lot of very dangerous behavior. In my own studies of cruising, I've seen cars make a U-turn in the middle of the street when they see a vacancy on the other side. I've seen it cause accidents. The drivers, they're not paying attention to pedestrians or cyclists. They're trying to see whether somebody is reaching in his pocket for, you know, the ignition key, or maybe to see where a backup light went on a car that's parked. And this does lead to very dangerous behavior. Here's a sort of video that's sort of grainy, but it shows what can happen. Interviewed the driver afterwards, and she said she does whatever it takes to get a curb parking space. Well, on the left summarizes our studies in Westwood Village, a little 15-block area, commercial area next to the UCLA campus. And it was 50 cents an hour, and the cheapest off-street parking was $2 an hour, so there was a lot of cruising. And we estimated that it took about 3.3 minutes to find a curb space, on average, sometimes much more, sometimes no time at all. But then that's not too much. That's only 2.5 times around the block. And if you can save $1.50, that's a good deal. But if it took us 3 minutes to find a curb parking space, it probably took other people 3 minutes to find a parking space. And when you add all of that up, a half a mile of cruising, when you add all of that up, for all the people who park at a parking meter in Westwood Village, there are just 470 of them, that's almost 1 million miles of vehicle travel in a single year. That's 4 trips to the moon, or 36 trips around the earth hunting for curb parking that's underpriced. And I'm sure it's happening right now in Melbourne. I'm sure it's happening in cities all over the earth. simply because of the wrong price signals that cities are sending. Cities are keeping curb parking free or cheap, and then to solve the shortage of curb parking, they require lots of off-street parking. So I think that the better solution is the one on the right, where you get the price right, and there should be one or two vacant spaces on each block, and there's no point in cruising. You can't save money by cruising, because it'll just waste your time and your money. That you should either pay it to park at the curb, or you should pay to park off-street. You should pay to park, rather than spend your time and other people's time as well. So here's a nice image from the New York Times showing, illustrating what's happening. Now, many people think that, oh, we can't do this because they have the image of what a parking meter is. This is the first parking meter in the world, installed in Oklahoma City in 1935. And from the user's point of view, that most parking meters in the United States and some here in Melbourne work exactly the same way. You put your money into the parking meter and you hope to get back before the time runs out, so you won't get a ticket. And that's why the early parking meters were described as a hellish combination of a slot machine and an alarm clock. You know, people thought it was just outrageous to charge for parking. Well, we've gotten kind of used to it. But people think that, well, we can't vary the price by time of day and day of the week and nudge it up and nudge it down and look at occupancy. That's too difficult. But that's because many people don't know how modern the technology is. And much of the new technology does come from Australia. The Rhino meters that I see here, that they're very common in Los Angeles. Here's a different one from a Canadian one. Most of the new technology, I'm sorry to say, comes from outside the United States. This is on the UCLA campus. This is a company that tried to make the new park meter sort of reminiscent of the old ones, looking kind of retro, so that the motorists won't be confused when they go to it. But when you go to this, it doesn't say anywhere what is the right what is the price of parking. Nothing is ever printed as what is the price of parking, at least these at the UCLA campus. You have to touch a button, and then it tells you the price at that time in that place. You can remotely change the price. You don't have to touch the parking meters to change the prices. Now, some people may say that, oh, well, this is too much to charge students, you know, $3 for the first hour and $4 for the second hour. That's extortion. The students don't have enough money. The students would say that, except when they get used to it. So I say you can't tell whether the price is right until you look at the results. Nobody can predict what is the right price of parking. You have to find it. And so we can look and say, is this the right price in this location at this time? So here are eight parking spaces. I think about one out of eight spaces should be vacant. Some of you probably suspect that it's sort of annoyed you that you think that professors have a lot of spare time, and there is something to that. So I set up my camera across from this parking meter and took a picture every 4 minutes for an hour to see, well, what were the results? Is this price right? Is it too high or is it too low? So you'll see the shadows move as I took a picture every 4 minutes. And you can see the two cars on either end never moved. But your goal is to have one or two vacant spaces. So here's the first one. You can see one car left, one arrived. This is the one time where all the spaces were occupied. Another 4 minutes, there was a space. Sometimes there were two spaces. We'll go back to one. Now, if you look at the results, would you say that price is too high or too low? I think it's just about right. It's as good as you're going to get. And nobody could have told me beforehand that would result. The price is lower on the weekends, the price is lower at night. that once there were three spaces, but then filled up to two. I think that's pretty good performance. And if any of you from your cities, yeah, I know that some of you represent cities, would you say that the curb parking works as well in your city? If we look or walk around in the Melbourne CBD, does the curb parking work that well? In some parts of Melbourne, the CBD, I noticed that there half of the curb spaces are vacant. I think the price is too high at $4 an hour at that time in those places. But there was one time, an early evening, on Exhibition Street, there was a massive traffic, just congealed. And in cases like that, I usually stand there and look at the curb parking, and the first car that I saw leave the curb space, the space was occupied by the next car in traffic. The first car that could take it did take it, and that suggests to me that a lot of the traffic was hunting for cheap curb parking, because that's the price the city sets. So in San Francisco, they would say, well, the way we deal with that is to nudge up the price of parking at that time in that location and see what happens. But if you don't have the willingness to look at the results and take them seriously, you're bound to get things wrong. So I just put together a bar chart showing what was the number of open spaces on the horizontal axis, the percentage of the time that was open, and it was probably as good as you're going to get. For a small part of the time, there was no empty spaces, and for a small part of the time, there were three empty spaces, but mostly it was one or two spaces, and that's not bad. The parking spaces are well used, but they're readily available. And if you don't want to pay that price, you can park farther away at a parking structure and pay less. That's only if you probably want to park for a short time to go to the library, that's right outside the law school library, maybe that's the best use of those spaces. Now, you don't have to have a professor standing there with a camera. This in San Francisco, they have these sensors that wirelessly communicate to the central command agency is to show what is the whether each space is occupied or vacant, and then the meters communicate wirelessly whether they're paid for. So the headquarters knows exactly where there are the most spaces that are occupied but not paid for. So they, instead of having enforcement people roaming around looking for violations, they send the enforcement people to where there are violations. So you can't tell what the right price is without looking at the results. And I think that it'll be what they call fine-grained, that it could be vary from block to block. So it's the lowest price that you can get and still have things work right. Well, the second reform that I recommended was returning some or all of the revenue to the meter districts. Here's a meter in Pasadena, where they say what that little, your meter money makes a difference in old Pasadena. If the money disappears into City Hall, you don't know what it's used for. It's probably used for somebody's, well, I won't attack any public servant here, but I mean, it'll probably be wasted. That's what a lot of people think. And we've had an election in the United States where a lot of these Tea Party things, people think that all the government money is wasted. But I think that you should return the revenue and spend it on physical improvements that people can see are paid for by the meter revenue. Here's picture taken outside near the Los Angeles Coliseum during the 1984 Olympics, showing what happens around any event at the Coliseum, which doesn't have much parking, and so the residents always move their cars onto the street and sell the space in their driveways. So when they get the money, they understand what is the right price. People say it's un-American or maybe un-Australian to charge for curb parking. Well, I think it's very American to charge people for what they use. I don't think you become a great nation by being freeloaders. And that somehow we have to figure out how to reform parking so that it operates as well as the rest of the economy. So I think that it is fair to charge people a performance price for curb parking. And it worked at Old Pasadena. Here's the plans for Old Pasadena. Someone reminded me a bit of what I've seen, say, like on, well, I won't, Elizabeth Street in the CBD. There were wonderful buildings in terrible condition. Except it was much worse. You know, the nothing was as good as what it looks like in Melbourne. But people, mainly empty stores. We knew the solution then. That was called urban renewal. Tear it down and rebuild it with all the required parking. Here's what was replaced. And do you think anything good could ever happen in that building? It had all the required parking, but it just looks terrible. And then they tore down three blocks on the main drive to build an enclosed mall. That was what we thought was progress. It had lots of parking. But here's Old Pasadena now. How did they turn it around? How did you go from a slum, a skid row, to one of the most popular destinations in Southern California, where 30,000 people come on a weekend just to walk around and enjoy it? And then they had three solutions. They charged the right price for curb parking, they returned the revenue, and they greatly reduced the off-street parking requirements. The city of Pasadena actually wanted to put in the meters, and the merchants and the landowners and the property owners said, no way, you know, that you've just built a mall down there, and this putting in meters will chase away the few customers we have. The merchants and their employees all parked on the curb and complained about the lack of parking for their customers. So they argued for 2 years, and finally the city said, all right, if we put in the meters, you'll get the money. And like that, that's different. You didn't tell us that. Let's run the meters till midnight. Let's run them on Sunday. Let's charge a high price. It was the main thing that made people understand the right price for curb parking was that they didn't get the money individually. They got it in public services. The public services are really quite spectacular, at least for the Southern California version, that they rebuild all the sidewalks. They sweep the sidewalks every night, remove graffiti every night. They steam clean the sidewalks twice a month. The place is immaculate. All new street furniture, all new street trees. It looks quite beautiful. And they had money to meter money to show what they were up to. And here's a quote from the a business leader who became chair of the advisory board, so that to show that the locals had some control over the money. Just think about that attitude towards meters. When we figured out that the money would stay here, that the money would be used to improve the amenities, it was an easy sell. Now, how many of you have had an easy sell with putting in parking meters? And it has made a huge difference. Usually, other cities that have this on their meters, one of them, San Diego, says turning small change into big changes. You can see all the new trees and the here's a before and an after that they restored their buildings because they didn't restore them previously because the increased rent wouldn't pay for the investment. There was no point in it. But once the city did what only the city can do, which is to provide the best quality public services available, then the property owners followed through with their share of stripping off, you know, decades of paint and restoring their buildings. Most of the buildings, or all the buildings, were empty above the first floor and empty on the first floor. Here's an old tire warehouse that had been vacant for many years that became a department store. They now even have a Tiffany's, Now, not every neighborhood wants or needs Tiffany's, but just think of the sales tax revenue and the property tax revenue. By giving this little bit of meter money to an area for public services, the whole city benefited from increased tax revenue and employment. Just think of how many people are employed working in Old Pasadena now compared to what it had been in the past. How many families this is supporting? Previously, the alleys were just in terrible shape. They used the meter money to repave the alleys with cobblestones and street trees. They put the wires underground, and now they're used for sidewalk cafes, rather like some of your laneways are here. So I think they did a very good job. Now, here's a quote ending up with a sort of a crude Californianism, but I'll tell you what, for this I will pay. Because when people put their money in the parking meters and they get out of their cars into a very high quality public environment, which they don't get everywhere. Now, when I, as you know, I'm a bit of an evangelist. I've been around to a lot of places trying to tell people that there are better ways to do things. And almost every place, maybe not here, but if I go to a city, there'll be some guy who will stand up. It's always a guy. Say, if you start running the parking meters at night in downtown Santa Rosa, I'll never come down here to a restaurant again. Well, I think it's because they blocked out of their mind. What I'm trying to say is that the 85% occupancy rate means the parking spaces will be well used and readily available. And that if you use the money to improve the public services, you'll attract more customers. You have your choice of poor public services and free parking, and these visible benefits will draw more people. But always this guy, sometimes there's spittle or even foam coming out of his mouth, say, I'll never come down here again. And I, the last time that this happened, I said, well, it was also a city hall like this. And the city council was there, and I said, well, if you don't come here, somebody else will take your parking space. And who do you think will leave a bigger tip at a restaurant or buy more in a store? Somebody who says, I'll never go any place where I have to pay for parking, or somebody who is willing to pay for parking if they can easily find a space right where they want to park. And if I said it to this guy, and if you don't want to come down here to pay for parking in downtown Santa Rosa, maybe you'll find you get a better deal in the food court at a suburban mall with ample free parking. So everybody will be better off. So I don't think it is reasonable to say that it's going to harm an area to charge for curb parking and return the revenue for added public services. You will drive some people away, but they'll be replaced by other people who value a higher quality public environment. And they say it'll harm the businesses. Well, here's the sales tax revenue from these areas, from Old Pasadena. It had the lowest sales tax revenue collectively in the whole city before this began. And then as soon as they put the parking meters in 1992, the sales tax revenue, which meaning the sales and the people who were employed there, all of that took off. So the economic consequences for the whole city are much better, I think. And the interesting thing about this, I think, is that the legislative language is so simple that here is the actual ordinance in a city that was adopting this. The young planner, as they say, drank the Kool-Aid. He thought, well, we could do this in Redwood City. And he convinced the merchants it was their idea to do this. And they lobbied the city council, passed it unanimously. This is the legislative language. So that the city council gave up on the idea of setting curb parking prices. They're not trained for this. They don't want to do it. They don't know how to do it. They don't know whether it should be $4 or $2 or $8 or $1. But the city council can set policies. So they set a policy goal of about 85% occupancy, and they assign that the transportation manager the responsibility for achieving this. And they gave him the responsibility, I mean the authority to move prices up or down. So you can just look out the window and see whether the staff is performing well. And to make this politically possible, they said that they're going to return all the money to the meter district. So I guess one thing I'd like you to take away from this is that you can ask your city officials, why can't we do this in our town? The language is so simple. It's so easy. Well, I shouldn't say it's that easy to do because it isn't, but other cities are doing it. Maybe we should consider it. And then the third recommendation I had was to reduce off-street parking requirements, because the prices are now going to do the planning for parking. The prices are what's going to adjust to get the results that we want. So here's this Silicon Valley, and you can see that when you actually look a little bit farther away, that pattern is everywhere. I mean, is that a sustainable future? When you actually go into the parking lots, they're not that bad. I mean, they're well landscaped, and there's wonderful vistas in the distance. I mean, that's as good as a parking lot can get. So I think that it's really quite beautiful. It's a great place to be if you're a car. But what might this look like if you could convert some of it to housing? So I used Photoshop and took some buildings from the University of London to put it in. That's not really the sort of thing that would happen, but they must have been just fresh and clean. So it shows up what I'm saying, that if the city allowed this to happen, say, if you want to build housing on this parking lot, you can, around the periphery. It was at a new urbanist conference, and they liked this kind of building, and they call this a liner building, that it lines the parking lot on the perimeter. So when you walk along the street, you don't even know there's a parking lot there. The land is already under one ownership. It's assembled. It's ready to build if the city would allow it to happen, which the city will not now, because you have to have all that parking for the buildings in the middle, and then you'd have to have additional parking for the housing itself. So I said, well, what really might it look like? So I took a sort of a more pedestrian apartment building from downtown Los Angeles, and said, well, suppose we allowed it to happen to see what would happen. You know, that they complain about the shortage of housing for workers in Silicon Valley and the terrible traffic congestion and air pollution. Well, this would allow to have job-adjacent housing, which they could rent to their own employees at a lower price, or they could rent it at the market price. So as you walked along the street, it would look like a real city. At least to the extent that downtown Los Angeles looks like a real city. And if that worked out, you could build some more. It's an incremental policy. And if that worked out, you could build even more. And you could slowly morph into what we think of as a real city if there's a demand for it. It would allow the market to sort out where people want to live and how they want to travel without telling them how many parking spaces they have to have. And of course, you'd have to charge for the curb parking on the streets in front of it, so that everybody who lived in those apartment buildings, they'd have to pay for their parking. The parking would be unbundled from the housing. You know, now the parking comes along with the housing, so we have expensive housing and free parking. I think we've got our priorities the wrong way around. I think we should have more expensive parking and cheaper housing, which it would be if you unbundled, separated the price of the parking from the price of the housing. So I think that there are some certainly good results. You would respond to a lot of complaints about living in Silicon Valley: the long commutes, the traffic congestion, the air pollution, the energy consumption, the oil dependence, high housing costs, maybe even global warming. So getting rid of these parking requirements and charging the right price for housing will do a lot to solve some of these problems. I mean, all these things that people want to happen and that in your Victoria planning provisions, set are your goals, I think they are all blocked by minimum parking requirements and free curb parking. So, I mean, there, if you want to do these things, if you think I'm just putting together some nice things that we want to happen, who could object to any of these things? Then I think you, and you could do it quickly, and without a lot, without any government spending, without any subsidies, without any urban renewal, just allowing it to happen. I think the first thing to do is to get the price of curb parking right, and then spend the money for local public services and remove the off-street parking requirements. So I think that we have a choice. I think every city on earth really has a choice, and we can change nothing. We can't change the past. You know, there's nothing we can do about that. But we can change the future if we want to. But many people don't want to. Change the other, keep the curb parking free or cheap, because it would be politically too difficult to ask people to pay for parking. And keep on requiring lots of off-street parking. For every land use, from bowling greens to funeral parlors to taverns to all the other things that are in your Victorian planning code. So then the cost of parking will remain hidden in higher prices for everything else. And free parking will continue to skew our transportation choices towards cars. We'll continue to design our cities around this distortion. We'll commit scarce land and capital to supply free parking and neglect a lot of other goals. We'll waste more time in traffic and consume more energy and import more oil and breathe dirtier air and pay more for everything except parking. And everyone will have to pay for parking, even if they're too poor to own a car. And it'll be difficult to have a good public transportation system, as implied by this awful ad trying to encourage people to buy a cheap new car, which would then have to support by paying for insurance and tires and oil and registration fees. We'll continue to buy big cars, and we'll need more roads to drive them on. And we'll continue building our cities like this. I'm sure that looks like a Photoshop, but maybe it wasn't. And then there won't be the kind of environment where you want to walk or bicycle. And of course, we'll have lots of traffic congestion, because we won't have congestion pricing. So everybody driving from one free parking space to another will congest the roads. I think, you know, every day, LA's traffic congestion looks like a mass evacuation before a hurricane. And it's because most of us see parking as a personal issue rather than as a public policy issue. I think that somehow people's critical and analytic faculties seem to shift to a lower level of intellectual prowess when they think about parking. That they use the part of their brain called the reptilian cortex. They say that's the part of your brain at the back of the first part that developed to make snap decisions like how to avoid being eaten. But it's not the way to make good decisions, good public policy decisions. But I think we do have a second future that would be more desirable. You charge fair market prices for curb parking, and you can use the money to improve the metered neighborhoods and remove your off-street parking requirements. So I think cities would slowly morph into a different form as a result of that. The cost of parking will slowly become unbundled from the prices for everything else. And people will slowly begin to drive less and walk more, and will waste less time in traffic and have cleaner air and pay less for everything except parking. So I think one of the ways to do this is what I call a parking benefit district, that you charge prices for curb parking. in this district. They have very distinct boundaries. Say in Old Pasadena, there was a Catholic church that didn't want its congregation to have to pay for parking, so the border was changed in front of the Catholic church. There's no street sweeping. There's no meter cleaning. They didn't get their sidewalks fixed. It was their choice. I think it should be their choice, but they have to choose. And this money will pay for a wide variety of public investments on the metered blocks. I mean, wouldn't you like that downtown in the CBD, your sidewalks steam cleaned twice a month? So it really was quite simple with this Redwood City Court ordinance. And the other thing that happened in Redwood City is that they removed the time limits of the curb. It isn't a one-hour meter. You can park as long as you want because the meters now cost more than the off-street parking. People who want to park for a long time, most of them naturally gravitate towards the cheaper off-street parking. But if you want to park, maybe you're a carpool of four people. You split the cost of parking, it's very cheap. So it'll draw the short-term parkers and the carpools to the expensive parking. Here's another city that they just changed the language and said they want a 50% vacancy rate. This is, again, the city, the ordinance. And they removed the time restrictions and they returned the money. And then here was the sign I just passed through there just a couple months ago, just before it started. They're going to begin. They've just started the meters on September 14th. They have these big signs on the meters saying that all that revenue will be used for a cleaner and safer downtown. Now, that's a lot different from saying all the meter revenue will go into the general fund. It's a huge difference. And here's one of the links on the website. Now, here's a T-shirt that my students gave me. This is what the kind of world that I'm talking about. Well, it is, sort of. Where the parking is scarce, you should pay for it. And I think it'll be a healthier world. Here's a stencil on the street that I like. For those of you who are cyclists in the audience, you'll see that, well, yes, the other people could learn to live the way that we live and evolve the way that we have evolved. What will we do with all the cars that we don't need anymore? Here's a sculpture in France called Long-Term Parking, which I like. And all these garages, what will we do with this? Here's one in the Netherlands, and they found a very good new use for it. I think the audience here would be a very good performance group for this. That we can find very new ways of repurposing this garage, the land and the capital that we now devote to parking. One of the ways that cities have begun using their parking lots better is putting these wonderful solar trellises on the lots. They provide shade for cars and electricity. But I think no matter what we do, parking will always be a problem. That unless perhaps General Motors succeeds with this new trick that they're working on, if this technology pans out, I think it will restore the leadership of the American auto industry, although I suspect that some of the parking operators in the audience will not like it. Here's the advanced knowledge of what we're going to have. I'd like to have one of those. Well, I think an urban planner can't do anything better than conclude with a quote from Jane Jacobs. I realize that today's planning students will be the ones who will have to make the profession's gifts of the future. I think that we didn't... We're not rich nations now because of what we've done. We're rich nations and successful nations because of what we've inherited. And I think it's our responsibility to make sure that there's something left after we leave. And a lot of our parking policies conflict with a better future. I think we're not making gifts to the future with our current parking policies. And also, I don't think anybody can do better than to quote from Abraham Lincoln, I think our case is new. That in the 1950s, when a lot of our parking policies were set and with minimum parking requirements, and we learned how to drive everywhere, the world seemed somewhat limitless. But now that we have different problems, energy dependence, maybe even global warming, but we still have the problems that our cities aren't performing as well as they should. Some people have almost lost faith that cities can perform brilliantly, that they can really do a great job. But I think that the example of the old Pasadena and some other cities show that the cities can do a wonderful job if they get the prices right. So I've just conclude again that it's more like an Alice in Wonderland, and once you say something three times that is true, then I'll say they are these three reforms that I think can make a big difference. Well, that's about all I know, so I better stop. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you.